Start in about 1 minute. We're going to give a few people a bit of time to just join, but just to give you your 1 minute warning, we'll start in 60 seconds. Well, good morning and welcome to this Tineo Insights call. Brexit is back. Try not to get too depressed. It seemed to be the only subject for about 4 years. Then COVID-19 came along and it disappeared as if it might have been a fever dream. But now comes the second wave of Brexit, or in reality, the attempted deal on trade and sundry other things. And many other old familiar rails are back. Let's be clear at the start of this. This isn't going to be a call on the rights and wrongs of the decision to leave the European Union on that fateful day in June 2016. Instead, hopefully, it's going to be a cold, rational look at where we are, what we can expect going forward, and most specifically, what it means for businesses. Perhaps the biggest issue we'll deal with is uncertainty. Will there be a deal or not? It's become a cliche to say that in any time-limited negotiation, concessions are saved for the last moment, and it all plays out in the crucial final hours. But the clanging of sabres over a level playing field, state aid and fishing are very loud. And there's a definite woozy feel as we peer over the edge into no deal. Then we'll be looking at what kind of country we actually want to be. The government says it wants to build back better, not just after COVID, but after Brexit too. Others, like Theresa May and John Major, get angry and anxious at the sight of a cabinet minister standing in the Commons and saying breezily that the government intends to break the law by reneging on key elements of the withdrawal agreement, suggesting that if we are a country that is prepared to flout the rule of law, we'll have a very rough ride in the international community. Confusion reigns. But once again, we've been able to assemble the perfect panel to help navigate these treacherous waters. Andrea Leadsom was a leading light of the Leave campaign and was also Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy at a critical time. She'll be talking about why she thinks we should be confident of our Brexit future. Amber Rudd was front and centre in the Remain campaign, famously saying that she felt Boris was the light and soul of the party, but she wouldn't want him to drive her home. She'll help us understand what the government is up to. Matt Fry is the presenter of Channel 4 News. He's also its Europe editor. He'll take us through the various staging posts to deal or no deal. And Paul Christofferson works for Tineo in Brussels. He'll give us his perspective from the other side of the channel. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for outside broadcast or publication. So that done, let's get to it. Andrea, let's start with you. Lots of uncertainty. You were Secretary of State for Business. What would you say to businesses that are feeling nervous at the moment?
Well, first of all, just to completely set the scene, we have already left the EU. So we're not talking about, you know, some kind of extension to that. What we're talking about now is whether at the end of the transition period, at the end of this year, whether we have a free trade deal or whether we move to trading without a free trade deal, but with lots of measures that have already been put in place, whatever happens. So the whole concept of deal or no deal has gone away. There isn't a no deal outcome. It's whether there's a free trade deal that gets rid of tariffs and all non-tariff barriers, or whether that free trade is more restricted. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But essentially, at the moment, the challenge that we have is, of course, that the withdrawal agreement, an international treaty, has set out the principles under which we leave the EU, but left a number of areas that needed clarification by the joint committee. So if you like, the equivalent of the secondary legislation, the rules around those principles needed to be set by the Joint Committee. That has so far failed to happen. And so what this UK Internal Markets Bill sets out to do is to provide a kind of plan B in case the free trade talks fail altogether, so the Joint Committee fails to come up with anything useful. Then what the UK needs to do is to protect the Northern Ireland interests as a part of the United Kingdom and to resolve certain issues that remained unresolved in the withdrawal agreement. So I know there's a lot of talk about we're breaking an international treaty and so on and so on, but within that was a legal obligation on both sides to agree a free trade deal. And so it is incumbent on the government to try and force that to actually happen by the end of this year. And in my absolutely clear view, the government prioritises getting that free trade deal. There's no doubt it's in all of our interests to do that. So that's what's going on in my view politically right now. But turning to where we are, should there be no free trade deal agreed by the end of this year? I was, as you rightly say, Craig, business secretary and very closely involved with XO, which is the cabinet subcommittee chaired by Michael Gove, that is dealing for all eventualities, including not having a free trade deal. So in terms of smooth functioning at the ports, in terms of minimising customs declarations, in terms of enabling business travel for professional services and financial services and so on, and dealing with people moving around at the ports in the EU and here, and HGV travel and so on, and all of the kind of personal healthcare issues, a huge amount of work has been done to ensure that should we leave without a free trade deal, actually a lot of pathways will be smoothed. Some of the big challenges I was dealing with as business secretary were around state aid. I was certainly of the view that we should have a set of rules around state subsidies, not least of which because you do need to be able to differentiate as ministers between a business that has a very special, unique problem, which is not of their doing, that with a bit of state help can get through it, versus a business that's badly run or has come to the end of its natural life and therefore shouldn't be supported by the taxpayer. So for our own internal reasons, and of course for the UK internal market, it's really important that we have a set of rules around state subsidies. However, that is clearly not for the EU to be requiring us to abide by their state aid rules, and that is where one of the arguments comes. Secondly, on manufactured goods, rules of origin is a big issue that we were dealing with when I was business secretary. And that's around, to just give an example of electric vehicles, where batteries aren't made in the UK at the moment, and under rules of origin, because more than half the value of an electric car is therefore probably coming from Asia, we needed some special dispensations to enable non-tariff barriers and tariffs to be minimised to deal with the electric car sector. And the same is true with lots of other sectors around the rules of origin issue. So that's the up-to-date, in my view, situation for the UK government, still determined to get a free trade deal, but recognising that in areas like state aid, ECJ jurisdiction, fishing rights and so on, the UK has to be allowed to go its own way. My very final point is that the future is for the UK to lead the world in green technologies, for net zero to become a massive jobs and growth opportunity for the UK, not just at home, but in terms of exports and free trade deals. And also, I think the UK will be a world leader in soft power, in democracy, human rights, in promoting the rule of law and so on. So I think that there's a very bright future. I continue to feel very, very optimistic about it. And I'll be very happy to take any questions from any colleagues on the call. Thanks.
Thanks, Andrea. Amber, like Andrea, you were very much at the heart of government and pulled this from the inside. Now you're on the outside and looking at it. Do you think it is as smooth and straightforward as that?
No, I don't think it's quite as smooth and straightforward as that. I cannot tell you how disappointed I am that Brexit is back on the agenda again. I thought that we had indeed left the EU and that, you know, I breathed a sigh of relief, as I think many Conservatives anyway did, that there was a sufficient majority, Boris could now get his deal and we could get on with more important things in a way. You know, and a country's wealth is not all about its trading relationships with the EU, and I was hopeful that we'd be able to do that. So it's a bit depressing that it's back on the agenda on this scale. I do recall the first time I went out to do Newsnight on behalf of the government after the referendum by representing Theresa May and her cabinet. And I referred at that point to the necessary compromise. And I got my hand slapped quite aggressively the next day by Number 10, who said, this is not about compromise. This is going to be about the UK setting the terms of its exit with the EU. Well, I'm afraid I think that she was wrong then and Boris Johnson is wrong now. We are going to need some sort of compromise. And ultimately, I believe that he and his advisers must know that. And what I find challenging, and I think is particularly difficult for business, is the constantly describing this in a way that it is all about the UK setting rules and not acknowledging that there's going to have to be compromise. And I think that what we're experiencing now really is the clashing of different promises that have been made. Yes, we can have this and we can have that and we can have it all our own way and we'll have our fishing rights back and we'll be able to do it exactly as we have set out. And what we have at the moment is the clashing where we can't actually deliver on all those things. And instead of the Prime Minister and his government going out and saying, we're leaving the European Union on terms which are good for the UK, this is what we're achieving, and this is the compromise that we are going to have to do. They are instead just raising the ante all the time, and none of us know where that will end up. The Internal Markets Bill is a necessary bill that would need to have taken place one way or another, and I know that the Theresa May's government was thinking about it as well. But there is no way that a government of the UK should be thinking about having a bill like the Internal Markets Bill and saying, and we're going to break international law. I'd still maintain that it is a shocking and extraordinary position to take. The Internal Markets Bill is necessary. We should be doing it without breaking the law. And I think that Boris Johnson will have trouble with that bill. I mean, we've seen that the Lords will object, but my understanding is that it will be amended at second reading. And Andrea is the expert on process, and I'll be interested to see what she thinks about that. But I think it will be amended on second reading by both tribes in the Conservative Party, as it were. The ones who do not want to break international law and think that that is something that is sacrosanct, I would be on that tribe naturally. And the ones on the other side, which I understand some of the ERG group are leading on, which are saying it doesn't go far enough with giving independence to the UK. And the key question on the second reading is who puts down those amendments? And my understanding is that if Theresa May decides to put down those amendments, she will garner a lot of support. So I think there is still very live issue around the House of Commons about what to do about this bill. We've already heard the deputy of 1922, Charles Walker, say he wouldn't support breaking the law. I am surprised and very disappointed that the government is going this way and saying it is perfectly all right to break international law. And that fight will go on. So Brexit is back. I find it very frustrating that it's back. I had hoped we would be able to deliver on the agreement the Prime Minister had got up to now. And I think it is very disruptive for businesses. But I think businesses are in the same position that they were really before the summer. Before the summer, people like myself were saying, we believe the likelihood is that there will be a deal, but prepare for the worst. I think we're now at a situation where we are more likely to get no deal. Therefore, that has to go up the agenda. But whichever way, we have to prepare for both, just as the government is doing. And a word about the XO committee, which I understand is now ramping up, both Andrea and I attended. I remember a lot of discussions about pet passports. I hope they've moved on a lot since then and got the country and its borders ready. Thank you.
Yes, it has. It has.
Good. Okay, thank you, Amber. I'm going to move on to Matt. We've all been saying how depressed we are that Brexit's back, but Matt looks like he's positively itching to cover this story. He's been scribbling notes and nodding his head and waiting to go. So, Matt, take us through what you think the staging posts are over the coming weeks and months.
Thank you very much, Craig. I think I am, to some extent, relieved, just because I'm sick and tired of speaking about COVID tests and trace every day and becoming an armchair epidemiologist, if I can still say that word, as we've all had to become. But actually, it was fascinating to hear Amber mention the one name that I've been really obsessed with this week, and that is Theresa May. Who would have thought, one would ever say that, especially as a journalist, but Theresa May as she stands, a kind of rather lonely, socially distanced figure in the House of Commons, you know, is absolutely fascinating. Because remember how she told us that her, you know, the naughtiest thing she ever did was to run through a wheat field. Well, I think she must be having a recurring nightmare at the moment, where she's running through the wheat field. There's a farmer at the other end of the field called Michel Barnier, and suddenly Boris Johnson comes along in a combine harvester and flattens the whole bloody lot. I think that's where she finds herself. And the points that she raises, you know, in the House of Commons are, of course, extremely valid. But in a sense, it also reminds us, rather as Amber was just pointing out, that she hoped there would be a deal by now, but there wasn't, that we would have been able to move on, that we hadn't. It also reminds us that the original conundrum posited by Brexit, the Gordian knot, the Fermat's theorem, call it what you like, is still there, and that is ultimately what is causing all these problems. How to respect an act of political divorce that was the referendum, while safeguarding a degree of economic community, protecting the EU single market, which for the EU is a political nostrum, and at the same time, safeguarding the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, this is a collision of politics, economics, and geography, and we haven't yet worked it out. I think Theresa May, partly because, I mean, she said too much with a thin majority at the beginning, then because of the disastrous snap election, you know, tried to untie that Gordian knot and obviously didn't work. Along comes Boris Johnson with a massive Alexander the Great cleaver and tries to cut it in half. So you get back to the, you know, to those extraordinary images about a year ago of Boris in Brussels, where he was greeted like an old friend. You know, people were, you know, kissing him and, you know, pre-COVID, of course, putting their arms around him. And it was this extraordinary feeling that here was someone who was finally in charge of his party, and here was someone who could finally perhaps deliver on Brexit. Here was someone who was weaponizing Brexit fatigue that had broken out on all sides. And then he signed up to the Northern Ireland Protocol, and they couldn't quite believe that he had done so. But they also couldn't quite believe, had they been told at the time, that he would be breaking his word on crucial aspects of it a year later. Now, getting back to the breaking of the word, it is churlish, frankly, in Brussels, whatever has been signed, to believe that a country like Britain, that is in the middle of a political revolution, will not try and use state aid at some stage to either beef up, you know, new sectors of industry that will define Britain's future, or indeed to save failing companies. Other countries in Europe have done so during the COVID era. Germany, Lufthansa is one example. It is also fanciful, I think, to believe that whatever has been signed will be acted on in terms of checks on the Irish Sea with goods travelling to and fro. But the point is, they did sign up to it, right? I mean, if you don't believe this stuff can happen, don't sign the piece of paper. And as someone admitted to me on air just a couple of days ago, Tory backbencher, famous Brexiteer, we signed up to it because we wanted to bring Brexit over the line. Because if they hadn't signed up, there wouldn't have been a deal. You know, there might have been an election which the Tories might have lost. So it was a political decision. And it's been fundamentally misunderstood by Brussels, just as we've misunderstood the political, you know, sacredness of much of what is going on in Europe. The more we have Trump and Putin and China, the more Europe will turn the EU into a political project. And I think that is something that we have fundamentally misunderstood. It is not just about transaction. It is beyond selling German cars or Italian Prosecco or French cheese to a British market. So this idea that we've got them over a barrel because they need us more than we need them, I'm afraid it's just nonsense. But that is, in a way, what is driving some of the government strategy. So, you know, are we going to end up with a no deal? I have to say, getting back to the old Gordian knot, Boris is prepared to use the cleaver to cut it in half, and the EU is increasingly prepared to let him do so. If you talk to people in Brussels or Berlin or Paris, they are more and more coming around to the idea, getting comfortable even with the idea, in a kind of vexed way, in a COVID way, that there will be a no-deal Brexit. And the minute that starts being part of the calculation, the minute that is being seen as something more probable, I think then you're into no-deal territory, basically. And we have yet, as journalists and indeed as politicians, to really honestly spell out the reality of what that means for both sides. And in the process, trust, I'm afraid, is being eroded, again, on both sides. But I think, I mean, a lot of it is, I'm afraid, comes from Westminster. If that trust is missing, it doesn't matter what you say at the end of the, you know, the final round of negotiations. It doesn't really matter what you sign on. You fundamentally undermine the nature of what should be a very friendly neighbourly relationship. There we go.
Matt, thank you very much. Lots to chew on there. Paul, I'm going to come to you next. You're in Brussels and looking at this. And start with something that a couple of years ago, lots of people said, look, the EU is this massive organisation, there's an awful lot of them and there's only one UK. Is the reality of what's going on here that the British government has actually managed to cause quite a lot of uncertainty in Brussels, and that's a good negotiating tactic to destabilise things? Because it feels like they're looking at us with bemusement and uncertainty and hoping they can do a deal, but not really sure they will. Paul, you're on mute.
Yes, we are looking at you with amusement and surprise, but to believe that this will make it easier to make a deal is a complete mistake. In general, I feel that too much attention in London is being paid to tactics. Some kind of Machiavellian process will somehow lead to a deal. This is not how Brussels operates. Brussels operates on substance, boring details, and these tactical plays will not bring the deal over the line. We actually thought that there was no need anymore for these tactical plays. After all, Boris Johnson has a comfortable majority in the parliament. And why do we need these kind of things? I would say that until last week, most people in Brussels believed that in the end there would be a deal. And basically, for a simple reason, that people could not be so crazy as throwing that away. Because, of course, it's true that it will be a bare-bone free trade agreement, but even a bare-bone free trade agreement meets a huge difference from no deal. I mean, in some sectors, customs duties still matter. Take the car industry, 10%. Take agriculture, take fisheries. People are all in the UK is all talking about access to UK waters. Nobody's talking about fisheries access to the EU market, and the UK is selling most of the fish it catches in its own waters to the EU. There would in a deal be certain kinds of customs facilitation. There will be customs control, but things like various ways in which to do the customs control behind the border probably could be agreed. There could be things agreed in the service sectors. There might be certain concessions agreed as far as rule of origin is concerned, not what the UK is asking for, but certainly something which would avoid that a major part of UK industry, because they cannot fulfill the normal 50% criteria for rules of origin, would have to pay full customs duties into the EU. And all of that you would have in 3 months' time. Now, if we don't have a deal, if we are going into operating on the WTO territory, of course there will be negotiations starting up in Brussels at a certain point of time. But then we are looking at the time perspective, which is 3 or 4 or 5 years before we could envisage a new deal with the UK. Because as and Andrea rightly said, the UK is no longer a member of the EU. the UK is a third country and will be dealt with as any other third country where doing a trade deal is about balancing interests on both sides. But I mean, this general belief that there would be a deal, of course, has been thrown off course by what has happened during the last week. And it is not minor thing that is being put on the table in the single market deal, which we are seeing day after day. As far as Northern Ireland is concerned, it concerns the key elements of the Northern Ireland deal. And it is not minor details which nobody saw when the deal was made. That was what we were debating about. That was what we were negotiating about. And the deal is not, for instance, as Matt said, as far as state aid, that there can be no state aid in Northern Ireland. Of course, there can be state aid in Northern Ireland, but there has to be a certain check and control corresponding to the EU.
Okay.
On state aid, we have been moving on our position. We are no longer asking alignment with EU rules. We are prepared to do a deal, but the proposal which we just saw yesterday, that we can trade on WTO conditions, is basically saying there will be no state aid policy. So
okay.
That's why not just myself, but others are becoming increasingly depressed.
Okay, Paul, thank you for that. We're getting quite a few questions coming through on the Q&A side of things. And the one that is obviously exercising a lot of people is this idea of the government openly saying it's breaking the law. Andrew, you're a conservative, and in conservative circles, this idea of the rule of law and Britain being a gold standard in the rule of law internationally, that's got to be a big issue for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And I'm not making any excuses. I do not support the UK breaking international law or domestic law. But will you allow me just to explain the equivalent of this? Because as Amber says, I'm the process nerd around here. And obviously that treaty is international law, okay? And in that international law, there is no concept of secondary legislation. So if you pass a law in the UK, that's primary legislation, you know, thou shalt not kill. And then in secondary legislation, you set out what does it mean to kill someone, okay? Now in international law, you agree a treaty, and that is the equivalent of the primary legislation in international law. And then there isn't the concept of secondary legislation. So in the case of the withdrawal agreement, because as we all know, we'd had 4 years of sheer hell, we're all traumatized by it to date. And so we just had to get it over the line. So it was agreed. And within it, as Amber will remember, Geoffrey Cox made clear, there's a legal duty on the EU and the UK to agree a free trade deal during the transition period, legally binding duty. So at the time, we were all as Brexiteers, as Remainers, thinking, okay, so the equivalent of the secondary legislation, the specific rules governing that treaty will be set out by this joint committee, this magical EU and UK body that would agree the fine details. Now, the problem that we have is that that has failed. And the reason that the UK, that I as a Brexiteer would give, is because the EU, understandably, and I have the greatest respect for the EU as an organisation and certainly for the member states. But the fact is that the EU is trying to make the UK continue to have ECJ jurisdiction, to abide by state aid rules, to have access to UK fishing waters, et cetera, and level playing field rules in a way that are not common to any other free trade deal. And that joint committee is in effect not making progress because the UK will not succumb to those rules which are not part of another free trade deal. So that secondary legislation equivalent to be done by the Joint Committee simply hasn't happened. So what the UK is doing is setting out in domestic UK law that clarity that the Joint Committee has so far failed to do. So as an actual matter of fact, the UK has not as yet broken the law. By introducing a bill doesn't mean you've broken the law. If it goes to royal assent, yeah. I mean,
it has a nice... It is true that it hasn't yet broken the law, but it has very clearly on the floor of the House of Commons said that it intends to, if it is willing to do so. And that has caused quite a lot of people with a big legal backgrounds in the Conservative Party to say that is, even saying that is a serious problem.
Okay, so and I completely agree with you there. So I'm not excusing it, but I just do want to say one other thing. There is a legal obligation on the EU and the UK in the Joint Committee to agree a free trade deal. So that is being broken also. And that, you know, so actually I'm not excusing it, and I'm totally not naive. We must not break international law, but this has been the most extraordinary negotiation of all negotiations getting out of the EU. It should never have been this hard. And so what this is as a tactic to try and force this issue to come to a head, it is not, as a matter of fact, and I want all of your listeners to be very clear, the UK has not broken international law. What it's doing is setting out a potential plan B in case the Joint Committee comes to nothing. Now, yeah, so there's no law
that's broken. Amber, let's just sort of try and unpick the politics of this. Another way of looking at this is that the British government did what it needed to do to unblock everything, get to a situation where it can go to a general election, tell people it's got Brexit done, everything's fine. And then suddenly they're in a position where actually they've got other conflicting problems and that kind of thing. And so they're now reneging. Is that fair or true? Or?
Oh, you cynic, Craig. Yes. I'm afraid I think there is a bit of that. They've just agreed and said they can do too many things, and it comes back to the compromise. Ultimately, they're going to have to say we can't do things. And I still think they could say that without having to break the law, international law, or actually go to no deal. I mean, on fisheries, for instance, which is something actually, as I used to represent Hastings and Rye, was close to my heart. They're going to have to compromise in some way in order to have better access to trade. It was ever going to be thus. And it's just disappointing that they're not airing now, while the Prime Minister has people's attention, has the majority, the fact that in order to get through this, we've got to have some sort of compromises. And the other thing, I'll just challenge Andrea a bit on her smooth explanation, which is fine, is that Number 10's response to this has been a little bit divergent from that, which is we agreed the withdrawal agreement in a rush.
Yes. Okay. So, Andrea, I'll let you come back on that in a minute. Matt, is this such a big deal, do you think, in terms of like the story, in terms of what's going on, in terms of how others see it? The Labour leader, Keir Starmer, had 6 questions in the House of Commons to Boris Johnson yesterday, and not one of them was on the fact that the government has said it's willing to break the law. He clearly didn't think it was that big a deal for him.
Oh, I disagree with that, Craig. I think it was a tactical move on his part to keep his powder dry, although why he didn't use one of those 6 questions, at least one, to address this as an issue of trust, when that has been his whole line of attack. We cannot trust this government, you know, to test and trace. We cannot trust their numbers, et cetera, et cetera. I'm amazed that he didn't put this into the lack of trust basket, but that's another matter. Let's leave that aside. I know from people in the Labour Party that they care deeply about this, and they will use it at some stage, but they're also afraid of upsetting, you know, voters in the northeast of the country or elsewhere that they want to win back from the Tories eventually. Well, the timing of that calculation, I think, is wonky. Anyway, I think in Brussels, as Paul referred to as well earlier, there has been a sort of gradual nibbling away of goodwill and trust for some time. But I think this has been the most important. This has been felt like a real hammer blow. And I'm afraid, Andrea, I don't think they're going to buy your explanation of this, that this is not the breaking of international law, especially when the government has said so itself openly in the House of Commons. So that then creates this sort of conundrum, which I referred to earlier, which is if they really don't want a deal, and I think increasingly that is the realization in Brussels, or the thinking in Brussels, then you know what? They won't have a deal, and we won't stop them from not having a deal. And again, it gets back to this balance between economics and politics. It is not just a transactional thing. It is also a political venture on all sides here. And I think the political side of it has become so much stronger under Ursula von der Leyen in the era of Trump, you know, and Putin, where the European Union feels more like a fortress than ever before. This has made the Union closer and not less close. At the same time, the challenge to COVID forced, you know, that was a real extinction moment for the EU. And I think that point where they came together and essentially for the first time persuaded German taxpayers to foot some of the bills of the projects of recovery, the beginnings, the very kind of early, you know, Jurassic Park beginnings of a sort of fiscal union, that is a crucial point that underpins their economic and political self-confidence. And for them, at this point in their evolution, Brexit, you know, with Boris Johnson breaking the law, is, you know, a hornet that has invaded the home, and they're just not prepared to put up with it much longer. And I think once you understand that, the kind of they need us more than us argument becomes utterly futile.
Paul, I want to bring this back to business in a minute. So just briefly, just tell us how this has gone down in Brussels. Do they think that the British government's made a big mistake by admitting that it's prepared to break the law?
In general terms, yes, but I must disagree with some of the things which Andrea said. First of all, there is secondary legislation. As she also said, the secondary legislation is what the Joint Committee can agree. The problem is the UK has never raised the question of state aid in the Joint Committee. And now suddenly they come up with a fit accompli. There is in the Joint Committee and in the Northern Ireland Protocol detailed rules on how you settle a divergence. The UK has not launched that process, but has taken things in their own hand. And the last point which I would like to make clear is that the North Irish Protocol applies whether or not there is agreement on a free trade agreement. It is not conditional on a free trade agreement. It's an international treaty which the UK has signed up to, which will last forever. Last comment to what Matt is saying. First of all, of course, Brexit has been high on the agenda in the UK, disappeared for a moment, and now it's coming back to a very high level again. This is not the case in Brussels. I mean, during the past year, Brexit has really not been discussed seriously at higher political level. We have had other things to deal with, new perspectives are opening. And this is also to some extent the case now. If the tactic was to provoke Merkel and the other leaders now to withdraw on their position, it's the wrong tactic. It will not work on the contrary. And there are industrialists and economic forces in Europe which are saying that, well, if things are like they are, we have tried to make a deal, but then we will live with a no deal. We have been preparing, and there are also opportunities for European industry in a no deal situation.
Okay, inevitably, this is coming back to you, Andrea. A lot of the comments that are coming through in the Q&A are basically around the uncertainty that business is facing. I suppose you must understand that they're sitting here thinking, are we going to be on WTO rules on the 1st of January? Are we going to have some kind of deal which makes it a bit more stable than that? What would you say to them listening to this conversation, which is a whole load of people having a lot of conversations about a lot of detailed things, but actually they're saying, I've got to run my business and we're not far off from this and I feel pretty uncertain and worried?
Thank you. So very quickly, Paul, it's simply not right to say that the UK side have never raised state aid. That is absolutely not the case. We were raising it right from the moment I became business secretary, right till the moment I stopped in February, and it's certainly been continuing since then. Secondly, I just reiterate to Matt, what I said is we have not broken the law. And that is a fact. We have not broken the law. By introducing a bill to Parliament does not break the law. It's if it gets royal assent that there would be a discussion about it. And actually, if you are a purist about these things, then you would see plenty of instances of laws being broken, such as the legal duty to have a free trade deal agreed. And finally, you know, to Amber's point, there have been huge compromises on all sides already. So if you look at, as you know, as Home Secretary, Amber, the immigration arrangements are incredibly generous to over 3 million EU citizens who have far greater rights than any other migrants to the UK. And quite rightly, I fully support that. But to say that there's no compromise and that there needs to be compromise is simply not the case. So my final point on that is I'm afraid to say I recognise I'm the only Brexiteer on the panel, but possibly the only Brexiteer on the call. And so I do think that the Boris brand is of this kind of angry sort of go it alone, blah, blah, blah. I think all of us need to recognise that is possibly each of your individual worldview. That is not my worldview. Boris actually is very socially liberal. He's economically keen to get on with other EU member states. He is part European himself. You know, all Brexiteers love Europe. We've been pasted into this corner with very little support from the media to do anything but. But to your very serious point, Craig, what about businesses? So it was always my absolute campaign at XO, this cabinet subcommittee, was that we must have a point at which we draw the line and we stop the discussions with the EU so that businesses know exactly what is going to be the situation on the 1st of January 21 at the end of the transition period. It was not going to be good enough to get to sort of 11:59 on the 31st of December. So that is why Boris, and that was settled government policy, you know, back in February when I was still in the job. So that is why Boris is saying, if we have made no progress by October Council, we will have to assume that we're not going to make progress. So that's not him posturing, that's him stating the case, which is government policy, because businesses need the certainty. Now, as we know, with all of the sort of marching up the hill and then marching down again with the false starts for Brexit over the last 4 years, businesses have spent a lot of money and a lot of hassle. And one of the problems we had that I was very conscious of as business secretary was businesses saying, I'm just not going to do it next time. You know, let me know when you're done, guys, and I'll do it then. So whether it was stockpiling medicines, whether it was warehousing parts for the supply chain, whatever it was, people needed to have that certainty. So that's what the government is trying to generate right now. So I totally hear businesses who say, well, what the hell are we supposed to do? But equally, I would say there are lots, BEIS does them, the Treasury does them, lots of phone-ins, lots of advice on gov.uk for what you should do to prepare for all eventualities. And I just hope everyone on this call is very aware of that and are taking part in that work. And particularly with their trade bodies, we're doing a lot of work to disseminate information through the very, very valuable UK trade bodies.
Okay, Amber, I think a lot of people on the call would go, hold on a minute, the Conservative Party hates the idea of state aid. It's like an anathema to a Conservative, the idea that you pick winners and do that kind of thing. And then they go, and the next thing that everybody's belly aching on about is fishing, which I think is less than 0.1% of the British economy. Again, for business, this is terrible, isn't it? You're creating huge amounts of uncertainty and arguing over something that the government shouldn't really be saying it believes in, and a tiny, tiny part of our GDP.
Yes, but this is comes to the core of what the Leave campaigners understood much better than the Remain campaigners, which is that it's a cultural issue and it's about more than just the economy and GDP. And the issue of fishing became very, very totemic. Remember all those boats and Nigel Farage and the fishermen. And it's absolutely essential that as part of the departure from the EU on the trading terms, that there is some difference at least in the fishing arrangements so that they can have a sort of triumphant moment of reclaiming the fishing waters. And as far as state aid is concerned, it is true. The UK, a Conservative government in the UK, would always want some sort of state aid arrangements, because otherwise we will have every MP from all over the country asking the government to save its biscuit factory, or the MP won't vote for certain legislation. Having some sort of state aid is going to be imperative. It's just that the government wants to have a state aid which it's designed totally separate to any negotiations with the EU, which I think is a bit actually of a wasted opportunity, because there's probably more alignment if there wasn't the emotional disagreement than people would naturally acknowledge. The sort of state aid that the UK needs to have is not going to be totally dissimilar to the EU one. It just doesn't want it controlled by the EU.
Matt, if you listen to the flow of this conversation, Matt, it feels like we're sort of persuading ourselves that there isn't going to be a deal, and that I think you're almost explicitly saying that that's the way it's leaning. Aren't we getting suckered into this idea of actually this is really negotiation, and at some stage something will give, and Boris will perhaps give a little bit and say, look how far I took us, because I was prepared to push it that hard, or the EU will give a little. Barnier's actually already compromised a number of areas. Are we sort of in danger of talking ourselves into the idea of no deal?
Well, maybe. I mean, you know, you could say last year he did precisely this. You know, he thumped his chest and he threw his toys out of the pram, and they ended up signing up to something which was remarkably a lot like Theresa May's original deal, actually. So, yes, you know, maybe there's a bit of bluster there, maybe we're falling for it. But don't underestimate the ability of people, actually on both sides, to get, you know, kind of fed up with this and to lose their patience and to say, you know what, if you really don't want it, fine, go ahead. And I think, you know, especially in the last week, and things were already pretty miserable in the last few months, I think we've reached that point, as I said earlier, where people in Brussels and Berlin and Paris, who obviously do want a deal, it's going to hurt them economically if they don't have it, but they're emotionally and politically in a different place, and their willingness to compromise on issues that they regard as sacred, and you could argue whether they should or they shouldn't, but they regard them as sacred as we do some of our issues here. Their willingness to compromise on those, I think, has been depleted somewhat. And so, again, my head is telling me there should be a deal, right? And there will be some kind of thin deal. My gut is telling me that there won't be. And I'm really not sure which organ to trust at this stage.
Yeah. And Paul, you're doing a very good job of showing the frustration of what's going on in Brussels and why you think there are technical issues and problems and, you know, breaches of trust and that kind of thing with Britain. Isn't the reality, though, that Germany does not want Britain sitting off the coast of Europe being able to set its own regulations and rules and with no deal? I mean, isn't the truth that that is something that they deeply feel more than they are willing to just walk away?
But that's the whole reason why the level playing field discussion is so important. The UK is so close to us, just on the other side of the channel. We are so integrated economically that it matters a shoot's deal what the UK does on state aid. And it's no use just to say that we will not go back to the 1970s, because you have other voices in the UK talking about other strategies. So we need some kind of rules on state aid. Barnier has declared that he's prepared to go back from our original proposal that the UK should follow EU, but you need some solid things here. It is true that we don't have very solid state aid rules with Canada or Japan, but there is one very good reason for that, and that is that we know what the Canadian and the Japanese state aid rules are. We have been living with them for years. We have great confidence. We have no idea what the future of UK state aid rules will be. And the answer given that we will follow WTO rules is a no answer.
Okay.
Of course, we have been discussing state aid over these past months a lot, but going back to Andrea's question disagreement with what I said. There has never been raised in the Joint Committee, which is the committee that deals with Northern Ireland problems, the idea that there would be deviation from what is in the protocol as far as and the
because you're never going to agree on whether or not this one's been raised or not. And I just wanted, because we're coming towards the end of the call, I want to do two more questions that I want everybody's view on. We're getting quite a lot of stuff, obviously, about uncertainty for business, but also this is happening at a time of COVID. Lots of families, uncertain jobs, futures, the economy. I'll start with you on this, Andrew, in the sense of like what it means for ordinary people, that kind of thing, in a time of COVID and uncertainty over the economy. Even if you put the best possible gloss on your case, Andrew, there's going to be a transition period or a difficult period where we reset this bright, brilliant new future. And that's going to mean some jobs going, some industries changing, that kind of thing. Are you not worried at a time of COVID that families are going to be really struggling in the economy and that kind of thing?
I mean, I worry about that constantly. I mean, I think coronavirus has been horrendous for our economy. And so part of me thinks the irony is we spent 4 years worrying about Brexit. We should have been worrying about coronavirus. But also, as a serious point, actually the lockdown was very much benefited by the preparations for Brexit and vice versa. You know, I think the increased use of digital technology, the increased use of sort of automation, hands-free stuff and so on has actually been very useful. I mean, if anything, you know, if one is grasping at silver linings, you know, COVID, lockdown and Brexit without a free trade deal have kind of backed each other up. You know, we didn't see shortages of medicines or food and so on. And so some of the preparations have stood us in good stead. But what I would say is that there isn't no deal, and we're already better than WTO terms. I mean, depending, I don't know who are your guests on the call, but, you know, as business secretary, I did so many round tables with businesses, big and small, in the four nations of the United Kingdom. And there was a wealth of research done on kind of bilateral arrangements and measures that would be put in place to make sure that things did work better than just WTO terms. So I completely hear you, Craig. I mean, that it is complicated, and I certainly hope that we will still get a free trade deal. And I hope that the threat of the UK legislating domestically to fill the gap, which you hear me saying, should have been provided under a legal agreement that by the Joint Committee, if that gap holds and the UK does then introduce this legislation, I hope personally that that will be enough to bring the EU to a more realistic position with the UK, where they're not trying to get the UK to sign up to things that are not part of a free trade deal with anybody else. So I still believe we will get a free trade deal, and I think it's very much in our interest that we do so. But I don't agree that if there isn't a free trade deal, that it's literally a free-for-all, as if we were, you know, dealing with, I don't know, a third country that's got no relevance to the EU at all. It's not as black and white as that.
So, Amber, with, you know, people worried about jobs, you know, savings, pensions, that kind of thing, businesses changing or going bust, that kind of thing, has this just really accentuated a coronavirus pain barrier? We didn't know this, the coronavirus was going to happen, but is it accentuating a pain barrier and making it worse over this autumn and winter period?
My last job in government was the Secretary of State for DWP, and attending the Exo no deal meetings, just in case there was a no deal, one of the things we had to ramp up was our ability to deliver universal credit to many more people. And so Anne has a good point, which is that due to that, I think, I like to take credit wherever I can, obviously, the DWP has performed really well under such growing levels of unemployment. And if there hadn't been those preparation, I don't know whether it would have. So there, all that preparation for a bad scenario, in a way, a no-deal Brexit, did make sure that the government was in a better place this year when we were hit by COVID. But I do agree is that, you know, I feel that COVID is the real damage and danger being made to this country. And Brexit is being sort of accentuating those difficulties, being made, making everything a bit worse in terms of the political fights which it absorbs. You know, the idea that this parliament is now getting absorbed by more fights on Brexit, when it should be trying to work out how to help people, how to deliver on levelling up, how to challenge some of the difficulties in different communities, all those things which most MPs came into government, came into office to try to help with. Instead, once more, Brexit is sucking all that good energy out of the House of Commons, and I really resent it for that.
And Matt, do you think that ordinary people are just getting fed up with this and will make the government pay a price, or are they already so dug into their positions that they'll support whichever side they supported during the referendum?
Well, ask me again at the beginning of next year. You know, let's see how, you know, let's see how much, how painful COVID will be in terms of jobs and, you know, the price of goods and all the rest of it. And then let's see how much worse that will be made by the kind of Brexit we end up with or not. And I think eventually, you know, the chips are still falling. It'll be some time before they've landed. But I think eventually people will start to count them. And I think, in a sense, the government's great luxury is also its great curse. The 80-seat majority, you know, in a fixed-term parliament means that they've got a lot of time, you know, to get things right, but also a lot of time to get things wrong. And, you know, you're already beginning to see, you know, a little bit of panicking on the Tory backbenches about Boris and has he gone into a witness protection program over the summer? Well, that's now ended, obviously. But I think they have to be very careful. And I think people, you know, whether they voted for the Tories for the first time in 100 years in constituencies that have always been Labour, those people, as Boris himself said, that vote was lent to us. We need to pay them back. People will pay very close attention to how that works.
Okay. We've just got a couple of minutes left on the call, so I'm going to come to each of you in turn. So please no more than two sentences each. The $64,000 question, is there going to be a deal in the next couple of months, or are we going to end up crashing out with onto WTO terms? So first of all, Paul, do you think there is going to be a deal?
The chances are diminishing by the day. So I used to be in the school that said more than 60% for a deal. I'm now considerably below below 40%. The only point in which on which I agree with Boris Johnson is that we need a deal by mid-October, maybe, let's say end of October. That's the delay we have to do to conclude. And as things are today, as things are after this week, I am very skeptical that this will happen.
Amber, is there going to be a deal?
This week has shown us how volatile getting a deal or not getting a deal is. So if I were running a business, I would acknowledge that nobody knows, and I would definitely prepare for every outcome.
If I hold a gun to your head, what do you think is going to happen?
I tell them to put down that gun straight away. No, I suppose at the moment, no deal.
You're such a politician, Amber. Matt, is there going to be a deal?
I'm with Paul. You know, I think 30% deal, 70% no deal, you know, the chances are diminishing. Whatever said today, and I think some of the words said by Michel Barnier at his press conference this afternoon will probably be quite emollient. I think David Frost will say some emollient things, but fundamentally the ground has shifted. I don't think there, I think there probably won't be a deal. However, some of the damage of that will be able to be undone in a combination of, you know, mini deals to be passed at the beginning of next year under the umbrella of the no deal and maybe some industrial sector by sector arrangements. But it's going to be very messy, and I'm very happy I'm only a journalist and not a businessman right now.
Andrea.
Well, with the exception of his latter point, I think I agree with Matt. I think, you know, it has to be highly likely now that the EU side are not going to want to resolve points. And, you know, there's an outside chance of getting a deal, but it is very disappointing that we've come to this point. I certainly don't think it's all the UK side. It's not entirely the UK side. I've tried to make that clear on this call, not persuaded anyone, I'm sure, but I do not believe that it is all it's the wife's fault. She should know better. I think this is wife and husband, and the children are the ones who are going to suffer. So, yeah, I mean, I do think there will be lots of bilateral deals, as there already have been. Again, as I've tried to make clear, there will be lots of deals with different countries, some of whom have much greater interest and goodwill than others. But yeah, I do agree. If I don't believe in crystal ball gazing, but my hopes are fading of a deal at this point.
Okay, that sounds quite pessimistic from all of you. I just want to say thank you so much to everybody who's joined the call, to Amber, Paul, Matt. Special thank you to Andrea. It's always difficult when you're the one that's defending things, so thank you very much. If you switch on channel 4, you're the wife. If you switch on Channel 4 News in 5 minutes, you'll be able to discover whether or not Matt's done his shirt up to present the news. But otherwise, would you all give your virtual standing
from the news.
To a great team?
From the news.
You've been ditched. Okay, we won't get to see that.
I've been ditched because they said you can't go on like this. So I was going to work. No. I was going to do that, but then it was too wide, boy.
Anyway, thank you so much to everybody. I'm sure that you'll all be giving the virtual standing ovation to everybody, and thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye.